Fascism comes to America wearing the garb of the Democratic Party. And within hours, the biggest bloodbath ever seen since the end of the Second World War is due to begin on the tent city of Rafah, where sit 1.6 million people, almost three quarters of them, women and children, facing an onslaught of Israeli tanks, artillery, and infantry. And the International Criminal Court is on the verge of issuing arrest warrants for Netanyahu and his gang of killers. Or are they? It's all coming up in the next 2 hours on the Mother of All Talk Shows.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
I wasn't called to ask a question of the British Prime Minister today. I had my quota of questions for the week, too, to the Foreign Office Minister in the House of Commons yesterday. But if I had, I was going to say this. We in Britain all saw what a massacre looks like in London, in Hainault, yesterday, when a man with a sharp sword murdered a small child and tried to murder many more people before being stopped in his tracks, having wounded several by brave officers of London's Metropolitan Police. If he had not been stopped, and I pay tribute to the officers who stopped him, particularly the young woman officer who ran at him as he held a large samurai sword covered in the blood of a little boy in his hand. But tomorrow, maybe within 4 or 5 hours from the end of this show, a new massacre will ensue in the Gaza Strip, because the deadline given by the killer and his gang, Netanyahu, and the others who may soon face an international arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court, will begin their invasion of the tent city of Rafah. Rafah is a tiny, sleepy little town, or rather, it was. Now it is home to 1.6 million refugees, every one of them an international community responsibility, legally, never mind morally, every one of them the responsibility of the governments of the world as constituted in the United Nations. We are responsible for every person in Israel's illegally occupied territories, which includes Gaza. The 1.6 million people who now live there largely live in tents. And we've begun to see just how little protection those tents afford the 1.6 million living therein. Bombs are dropping on tents. Fire bombs are setting fire to the tents. Incendiary munition designed to set on fire tents in a massive refugee concentration are beginning to fall, and children are being scorched. I've just looked at a video of a little girl, her long hair flowing behind her, her face entirely blackened, entirely burned, every inch of her little body scorched deliberately by Israeli ordnance. The women and children who are there, and they constitute the vast majority of the 1.6 million, are looking at their watches, if they still have them, right now, wondering when daybreak comes if the Israeli army are really going to storm such a concentration of defenseless and vulnerable people. They've heard, of course, the President of the United States say that an invasion of Rafah would be unacceptable to him. They've heard the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom say that he is completely opposed to an invasion of Rafah. They may even have heard from the Deputy Foreign Minister in answer to my question yesterday that it is impossible to see, he said, how any invasion of Rafah could be in compliance with Israel's responsibilities under humanitarian law. The question, though, is what, if anything, are these leaders or anyone going to do about it?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If and when Netanyahu's invasion begins. Don't imagine that the men there will go down to the biggest slaughter seen in the world since the Second World War without a fight. There must be fighters in Rafah. Otherwise, Netanyahu would presumably have turned his gaze elsewhere, to the West Bank, to Jerusalem, to Lebanon, or somewhere he would have a man to fight, wouldn't he? He wouldn't be invading if it was only women and children there, would he? Maybe he would. But I'm pretty sure that there are men who are ready to defend their families in the face of the Israeli army onslaught expected within hours. The Israeli armed forces will suffer a high toll. 12 of them were already medevaced out of the outskirts of Rafah this very day, seriously wounded in some cases, stretcher cases, all of them. There will be many more. There will be many more Israeli invaders laid in their graves, disabled, suffering amputations, and perhaps above all, suffering mental illness from the trauma, the battle trauma that they are about to face. But of course, when your adversary has no air force, has no navy, has no artillery, has no air raid shelters, the outcome can only be one thing, which is mass slaughter. That the Israelis are capable and willing to commit such slaughter is already a commonplace. We have seen them doing it. Even in hospitals, we have seen them doing it. We have seen the bodies that they shot at point-blank range, their hands tied behind their backs, many of them doctors still in their medical clothes. We have seen many, many prisoners executed, shot dead, and laid in shallow graves. Maybe they even made them dig the graves before they killed them. We know that the so-called most moral army in the world is in fact the world's most immoral army. We know that they will not shrink from committing genocidal crimes because we've already seen them doing it. So the big question is, what will President Biden, what will Prime Minister Sunak, what will leader of the opposition, Starmer, in the UK Parliament, do about it? Will they continue business as usual with the killer Netanyahu? Will they continue to send weapons and money and provide diplomatic cover in the United Nations in the wake of one of the greatest war crimes since 1945? Will they really? Well, yes, of course, they will, because we've already seen them doing it. There is no need to look in the crystal ball. We can read the record of this last 6 months and more. We have seen so far that there is no crime so great, that there is no sin so venial, that Israel's Western partners and allies will not continue to facilitate it, enable it. And we know from the Western media that there is virtually not a single journalist who will stand out against it, who will report it truthfully, who will cry out in support of the oppressed, the dead, and the dying. They are with the killers. And if there is any journalist who decides that this far but no further, if there is any broadcaster who decides that they cannot continue to lie about crimes on this scale, they will be swiftly removed from their positions, as has already happened. Again, you don't need a crystal ball. You know what happened to little Mehdi Hassan after years of kissing the ass of the United States establishment, the British establishment, just because he was a Muslim who found some small sinew of empathy in his miserable little body. He was removed from MSNBC. A young woman called Singita, whose existence had evaded me until now, was just replaced from the London Broadcasting Corporation, LBC Radio, nowadays TV and radio, as is the way of these things, was sacked without any fanfare, without any announcement. She interviewed a spokesman for Netanyahu's government. She asked him a couple of absolutely ordinary professional questions, but the Israelis protested and Singita is no more. But hey, hallelujah, she's been replaced by Vanessa Feltz, a foghorn shill for Netanyahu, for Israel, and for their crimes. That's what will happen to any journalist who steps out of line. And that's why virtually none have stepped out of line, and in the hope that no others follow anybody who has stepped out of line. Ditto in the political process. If you are in the American Congress, AIPAC will spend any money necessary, millions of dollars, to completely unknown congressional opponents so that they can prove that standing up against Israeli crimes doesn't pay. You will lose your place in the legislature. You will lose office. You will lose all that comes with that office. And ditto here in the British Parliament. I am one of a tiny handful that you could count on one hand, certainly on two hands, who are ready to get to their feet and incur the wrath of the Israel lobby in Britain. 80% of all Conservative MPs are members of the Friends of Israel. Who knew? Anybody who knew the history of the British Conservative Party, anyone who'd visited the golf clubs of the Conservative MPs, could never have guessed that though you will not find a Jewish member in that golf club, you can be sure that the Member of Parliament is fully loyal to the State of Israel. 37% of Labour members of Parliament, almost 4 in 10, are members of the Labour Friends of Israel. But at the top ranks of the Labour Party, you simply will not be allowed to sit unless you have pledged your loyalty to a foreign state, moreover, a state condemned by the International Court of Justice, sent for trial, having plausibly, in the words of the court, committed the high crime, the highest crime of genocide. Sent for trial on genocide. But you will never be allowed to sit anywhere near the top of the table in the opposition Labour Party in Britain unless your loyalty to Netanyahu and his murder gang is guaranteed. So, no wonder then, given that most politicians are self-serving careerists, small businessmen and women, who are in it for the dough, who are in it for the kudos, who are in it for the best seat in the restaurant, who are in it for someone in a uniform calling them sir, who have not a scintilla of political or ideological belief or principle, no wonder then that so few of them are ready to risk their place in the political class. And so we have a scene of desolation, a scene of desolate silence about these crimes that I'm talking about. I saw the little scorched girl only because I'm on social media. She will never even be talked about, still less shown on any television channel. She will never feature on the front or even page 38 of any British newspaper. Her agony cuts no ice with the political and journalistic class in Britain. Her pain doesn't matter to them. Her blood is worthless to them. How else can it be that she will never be reported on? The truth is, in Western countries, we are living now in a state of moral and political bankruptcy. If we were a company, we'd be declared bankrupt. We have nothing of value about us anymore. We, who stood up to Hitler for a time alone, in 1940 and 41, while London was burning, our young men of 19, 20, 21 were taking to the skies to fight the Luftwaffe, the Messerschmitts, to shoot down the German bombers. Our young men were on the Channel coast waiting to bayonet the Nazi invader, even though we were by that time left alone. We, who spent the next half century talking about our moral capital earned by that generation of our young men, are now totally bankrupt. At Prime Minister's Questions today, the Leader of the Opposition asked every one of his six questions about the economic fate of the triple lock on pensions. Not one word did he whisper that a great war crime is due to begin tomorrow. That was left to the gallant young leader of the Scottish Nationalist Party, who gave both of his questions to that subject. It was left to the leader of the Green Party, who used her question powerfully to ask the question the Labour leader didn't have the guts or the moral fibre to ask, namely, what are you going to do if this great war crime begins tomorrow on schedule? And we have seen fascism come to America. The sons and daughters of the American people have been clubbed, have been shot with rubber bullets so far, have been gassed, have been attacked by fireworks, attacked by injected, diseased rodents released into their midst, have had their water cut off, their electricity cut off, their food forbidden, starving as if they were in Gaza. Who ordered it? Joe Biden and his Democratic Party factotums in the governor's halls, in the Senate and congressional offices of the Democrats, supported, just like here in Britain, by the party that gets paid a public salary to oppose the actions of the government, to hold the government accountable. Instead, both cheeks of the same ass are clenched tightly together, disgracing America, hurting their own constituents' children, ruining their lives, threatening them with no diplomas, no graduations, no references, their fees forfeited. That's what the West now looks like today. We've got the one and only Scott Ritter up right after this, so you better stay tuned.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
One of the world's most formidable and best known arms inspectors, with whom I've worked now for more years than either of us care to remember, but we are still enjoying it. Scott, let's start with what's happening in America. I never thought I'd see the day. Not when the cops were laying into young people protesting, because I'm so old I saw them killing students at Kent State University in 1970, 54 years ago. I saw how they treated the young demonstrators at the Democratic Party convention in Chicago in 1968. So I'm getting on. I'm not amazed at what the cops are doing to the young protesters protesting this war. I'm totally amazed that all the people that would have been protesting against the Vietnam War are now cheering on the bludgeoning to the ground of those protesting this one in Gaza. How do you feel about it?
George, when you first met me back in before the invasion of Iraq, I think you recognize that I was somewhat uncomfortable with the concept of public demonstrations. I was a military man. I was somebody who had been on the other side of the issue. I was offended by what the government was doing, but I was uncomfortable with protests and uncomfortable with participating in protests. But you and others convinced me that that's what needed to be done to get the message out. So I walked with you proudly in London. And I walked with others proudly. You have been consistent in your passion and in the methods of expressing your passion to include protest. I was surrounded in the United States by people of the Vietnam era, and they spoke of the necessity of reviving the spirit of the Vietnam protests. And they went into the streets and they protested and they screamed and they did what they did. And then they disappeared because they were very much the weakened warriors. They were the summer soldiers. They didn't have what it took to stick out the fight. Some people did, but by and large, these passionate protesters succumbed to the reality of time, the reality that for a protest to succeed, it needs to be sustainable. But they claim to be morally based. And I've watched them over the years attempt to revive the passion of protest. And they've been unable to do so because at the end of the day, they lack the passion. What we're finding out is they lack the conviction that they are simply empty suits, or should we say empty tie-dye t-shirts. These are not real protesters anymore. These are the fake of the fake. The students today have picked up the baton. They are running with this issue. They are doing that which you and I were demanding of others back in the day, back when we're trying to stop the Iraq war. They are on their own volition stepping up to the battle line. They are doing battle and they are paying the price. These aren't weekend warriors. These aren't summer soldiers. These are committed protesters for a cause that they deeply believe in. And at this time, at this moment in history, this is where those Vietnam War era protesters, those failed protesters of the Iraqi war, need to rise up and rally, because this is a just cause. This is a cause worthy of their sentiment, of their passions, of their sweat, and even of their blood. And yet they are silent. Not just silent, George, you are right. They are on the other side. These are traitors. These are treasonous beings. These are people who mean nothing. And I will say this right now to the anti-war movement in America today: go to hell. You have lost me forever, because you are not the anti-war movement. There is a genocide taking place in Gaza today. There is a horrific conflict that is costing tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians their lives. And you are silent, not just silent, but you are on the side of the police, the thuggish, brutish police who are coming in and enforcing the constitutionally questionable edicts and orders of the governors and the mayors and the school administrators. Freedom of speech means nothing in America today. Freedom of assembly means nothing. Yes, these students might be trespassing. So what? What do we want of our students, wherever you are in the world? You want people who have open minds and open hearts. They are going to university to learn to become good citizens, citizens who empower themselves with knowledge and information, but not just book learning, but to actually get out and be amongst the people, to learn the reality of life. And here they are confronted with one of the greatest evils in modern history, the genocide taking place in Gaza. And they have said, no, they will not remain silent. And they have done what we demand of good citizenship. They have stood up to be accounted, to hold people accountable. And the rest of society is backing away, especially those hypocrites who claim to be anti-war. There is no anti-war movement in America today. I mean, the anti-war movement is out there with the students. The students are there. The students have taken up this cause. But those who claim to be anti-war, those who disappointed me in the lead up to the Iraq war and disappointed me ever since, have proven that my disappointment was not, you know, falsely thrown out there. They are a disappointment. They are hypocrites. They are the worst of society, because they claim to be one thing, but they have been exposed as another. I am sickened by the fact that the anti-war movement in America today is silent, not just silent, but sitting on their butts cheering on the police that they once claimed to want to confront themselves. Liars, hypocrites, the scum of the earth.
Is Netanyahu going to invade Rafah in your view, Scott?
Yes, because nobody's going to stop him. There's no force out there right now that Netanyahu is afraid of. He's not afraid of Joe Biden. He's not afraid of the United States. He should be, but he's not. He's not afraid of the International Criminal Court. He's not afraid of the International Court of Justice. He's not afraid of the United Nations. He's not afraid of anything. So he is going to invade Rafah. He is going to commit a horrific crime. And the sad thing is, Egypt, which claimed this would be a red line worthy of war, will do nothing. Jordan, which claimed this is a red line worthy of war, will do nothing. I believe the world will be silent in the face of this, because at the end of the day, our governments lack the courage of conviction that those students have at Columbia University, University of Texas, UCLA, and other campuses, Emory College, across this nation.
The Israelis are paying a price on the ground in Gaza. They hide the true extent of their casualties, but Israel is an open society amongst the Jewish people there. They have freedoms that many in Arab countries don't have, and they are not able to conceal forever the damage that this is doing to their own young people. A number of the paratroopers who were supposed to turn up for duty in Rafah absconded. A number of soldiers are now refusing, and many, many soldiers have been killed and wounded. What sort of opposition might they face in the tents, amongst the tents, and amongst the now broken slums of Rafah?
Well, Hamas, as a military organization, has not been defeated. They've been bloodied. Let there be no doubt. There have been casualties on both sides, and Hamas has suffered casualties as well. But it is not a broken organization. We saw how quickly, once the Israelis withdrew from the north of Gaza and the center of Gaza, how quickly the Hamas fighters reasserted themselves in that area. And the ferocity and tenacity of the Hamas fighters, the proof of that is, of course, where some of Israel's most hardened infantry soldiers, the paratroopers, and from other elite brigades, Golani Brigade, are saying, we don't want to go back in there. This is not a fight we want to engage in. This will be a bloody fight. This will be a very bloody fight. But Israel has a new kind of stormtrooper that many in the West are unaware of. They have these reserve battalions of yeshiva students, Talmudic studies students, who are Orthodox, fanatically so. And for 5 years, they get to study in a Talmudic university while serving in a reserve battalion. These fanatics, these Jewish fanatics, are the ones who are implementing the Amalek instructions of Netanyahu. These are the people that you see with their arms around each other chanting that they will eradicate the seed of Amalek. These are the people who are desperately wanting to get into this fight because they despise the Palestinians. Despise is not the right word, because to despise something, you at least have to recognize the humanity of them. They don't recognize the Palestinian people as humans. They call them human animals, and they are going in there, and they have no qualms about killing children, about killing women, about killing innocents. These are the people that executed the people. These are the worst of the worst. These are the Israeli equivalents of the Einsatzgruppe, the SS executioners of Nazi Germany. And there are, unfortunately, sufficient battalions of this nature that Israel will be able to amass the military force necessary to move against Rafah. And these people will go against Rafah with no human compunction to show mercy. They will be merciless in the execution of the orders that they will be given.
So we're about to watch the biggest single bloodbath since the Second World War.
George, imagine, if you would, the Warsaw Ghetto, the infamous Warsaw Ghetto. Everybody's heard about the Nazi eradication of the Warsaw Ghetto. We're about to watch the modern-day manifestation of the Nazi eradication of the Warsaw Ghetto, live on TV, with the entire world knowing it's happening, watching it, the buildup, and then, like it's some sort of perverse pay-for-TV entertainment center, to watch it unfold and do nothing to stop it. You have the United States now, who once said you can't do this, talking about bringing in Gazans to the United States as a way of opening the door for the expulsion of the Gazan civilian population from Gaza, which has always been the Israeli objective from day one, to remove the Palestinians from Gaza. The United States is now taking a leading role in doing this. This is horrible, what's happening. It's a nightmare. And yet somehow the world has become so immune to the suffering of the Palestinians. I don't understand it, George. I don't know why the world doesn't view the Palestinian people as human beings that deserve the dignity, that deserve everything that we demand of ourselves. They deserve, and yet we're going to watch the eradication of Rafah in a military campaign every bit as brutal as the Nazi liquidation of the Warsaw Ghetto.
Well, most of the world can see it, of course. It's your country and mine, and a few others. We constitute some 14% of the world's population. Most of the rest of the world can see it all too clearly. I said in my monologue that really the West at this point is is morally and politically bankrupt. Do you share that view?
Absolutely. I mean, bankruptcy, you're actually insulting people that go through bankruptcy by saying that the West is bankrupt. The concept of bankruptcy implies at one point in time that we were solvent. There is no solvency here. There is no recovery. We're worse than bankrupt. We are decrepit. We are rotten. We are falling apart at the seams. We are the exact opposite of what we claim to be, which makes it even worse. I respect people more. Mm. I respect evil people who admit that they're evil. I say, at least you're honest about who you are. Mm-hmm. Here in the United States and in Europe and in the United Kingdom, we claim to be something that we're not. And in the most Orwellian fashion, we use double speak and double action. We say something, but we're going to do the exact opposite. This is beyond bankruptcy. This is literally the total manifestation of evil. We have become that which must be eradicated. And I say this as a proud American who believes in what America should be, but not what America has become. And at this point in time, if America can't heal itself, and it looks like the American people more and more are incapable of that kind of self-cure, maybe it's time for the world to say, America's not welcome amongst the civilized nations anymore. And I would say that the same holds true for the United Kingdom.
Yeah, alas, we may be two countries divided by a common language, as Oscar Wilde said, but we are absolutely on the same page when it comes to these crimes that we are discussing. Just lastly, and I'm deeply grateful for your time, will the invasion of Rafah make more or less likely the long-awaited warrant for the arrest of Netanyahu? And if it is issued, what difference will it make, Scott?
You know, one of the interesting things about this warrant is that the ICC has never talked about it. This is a figment of Netanyahu's imagination. He held an emergency session of his National Security Council where he raised this possibility, and then they leaked it to the Israeli press, and then they brought it to the United States. I'm thinking more and more that this is a political ploy by Netanyahu to heal the divisions that existed, because prior to the talk of the ICC, the Biden administration was talking about cutting off arms sales and otherwise opposing. There was a split. People were talking about the divide between Biden and Netanyahu. Today, you have the White House coming out in defense of Israel's genocidal policies. You have the United States Congress, the Speaker of the House, again, passing resolutions that seem to be defending Israel's genocidal behavior. This was a brilliant political move by Benjamin Netanyahu to throw something out there that the United States, he played us like a fine-tuned fiddle, because we have problems with the ICC in terms of its jurisdiction over, potential jurisdiction over American soldiers, et cetera. And we're vehemently against it. And so what he's done is he's taken any potential indictment of him and his defense minister and chief of staff and potentially other Israeli soldiers and said to the Americans, what if this was you? And the United States said, well, it can't be us. Therefore, we must step up to defend you. And suddenly there, Israel and the United States are joined at the hip. The United States is defending Israel's genocidal behavior. This is a disgustingly successful political ploy by Benjamin Netanyahu. I don't think there's a warrant under consideration at the ICC. And if there was, given the reaction of the United States, I don't think the ICC has the courage to issue that warrant now.
Scott Ritter, as always, deeply grateful, and thank you for your wisdom and experience. Scott Ritter, the former Marine Corps intelligence officer and the weapons inspector in Iraq and in the former Soviet territories after the fall of the Soviet Union, knows as much, if not more, about war and increasingly the politics behind war as any person alive. And we are lucky to have him here every single Wednesday with his war report. Let me take a quick break. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Larry Johnson's a veteran of the CIA and the State Department's Office of Counterterrorism. He's the founder of Berg Associates. And just last week, he was talking sense to the panjandrums of the United Nations Security Council. And we couldn't resist. We had to get a second opinion on the events that are going on now in the world. Larry, first of all, tell us what it was like at the United Nations. Were you well received? Tell us the essence of the message you delivered there.
Sure. I was well received. I was, in fact, seated next to the British delegation. Initially, just a young woman was seated in the chair, and then the British representative finally showed up. To his credit, unlike his disaster of a colleague from France, the British ambassador started off his remarks by thanking all of the briefers, which included me. I didn't even get thanks from my own country's representative. But apart from that, I was extremely well received by the Russians, by the Chinese, by the Algerians, representatives of Mozambique, Sierra Leone, even the representatives of Ecuador, Korea, and Japan were not dismissive. And the thrust of my message was, look, I've been involved with international money laundering investigations, with international criminal investigations surrounding the downing of Panam 103. I've been involved with planning terrorist operations while doing training exercises. So I know the kind of planning that goes into it. There's absolutely no reason in the world this has not been investigated by the UN, except for one reason. They already know who did it, and nobody wants to be out there. Most of these countries don't want to finger the United States as the supreme culprit, even though we know that that's who did it. And so my attempt was to try to shame the United Nations a little bit into doing its job and upholding actual international rules-based order instead of this selective prosecution where it's okay for the United States to destroy infrastructure that is critical to the economy of Germany. What's sort of shameful, though, in all of this is the fact
that the economy of Europe, in fact.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a terrorist act against Europe, not just Germany and Russia, the joint owners of the pipeline. It's had extremely serious impact on the environment. Everybody knows who did it, but no one will say so, not even the United Nations. It's an extraordinary example of lawlessness, isn't it?
Yeah, of course, I laugh. At least Liz Truss said it. You know, she sent off a text message, and Sikorsky, the former foreign minister of Poland, he sent off a tweet, oh, way to go, United States. So, you know, they clearly knew who did it. What's sort of disgraceful in this is that the purpose of this act had one single objective: destroy Russia's ability to supply cheap energy to Europe and try to compel the Europeans into buying from the United States. That's it. Greed. Pure, unadulterated greed. That's what this was all about.
It's gangsterism, yeah? I mean, if the mafia did a crime like this, you wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. The mafia would be more sensible about it. And yet, you'd be surprised at the number of Americans that you think would be more thoughtful, that are experienced, that are wealthy, that are well-educated, that said, oh, yeah, we had to destroy this because we couldn't allow Russia to supply Germany with cheap natural gas. That made Germany a vassal state. And I'm going, whoa, 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 wait a second. I thought this whole international economic theory about free trade operated on the principle that you try to pay the lowest price for a commodity, not the highest price, and that you don't punish a company, a country for being successful and producing something at a lower price. Good God, what are we talking about? Then what they wanted is traditional mercantilism that's based upon monopoly.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, turning to events in your country, the rest of the world is, at least those with access to alternative media, is transfixed at the sight of armored, armed, big thugs knocking hell out of boys and girls who are peacefully protesting against what's happening and what's about to happen in Gaza. And the liberals are cheering on, Larry. Has the country gone mad?
Well, you know, you and I are, I think, about the same age, and we can remember back in 68, 69, the anti-war protests. And what I'm struck by is the similarities, because back in 68, 69, when these anti-war protesters were coming out, they were being dismissed as outside agitators. They were under the control of foreign organizations and that their message was illegitimate. But the reality was their message was exactly right. The United States government was lying about the pretext for the war in Vietnam, and it was killing civilians in terrible numbers in Vietnam. So those protesters were right. Whether or not there was outside organization or agitators, the message was correct. There's a part of me that believes that there may actually be, if you will, the U.S. government helping organize and push these protests for one reason: to inoculate the American public so that it accepts police violence against protesters. So, you know, right now it's being portrayed as these are anti-Semitic protesters and they're threatening Jews. Well, I don't discount at all the likelihood that there are FBI provocateurs put into those crowds deliberately trying to initiate acts of violence to provoke a police response. But once Americans become accustomed to that police response, then come November, if there are protests against an election being stolen, then we're all on board with, these protesters are out of line. Beat them up. Put them in jail. And that's one of the, you know, it's so dangerous because this is a clear violation of the First Amendment.
Well, great minds think alike, Larry. I tweeted this very morning to the MAGA people, the Trump supporters, who are cheering on what's happening on campuses now all over America. This is what's in store for you when kill or jail or rob your hero of the presidency of the United States. Why can't you see that?
Yeah, no, because it's all emotion. You know, if you recall, think back how old you were when you saw the movie Exodus with Paul Newman, Lauren Bacall. That introduced a meme into the American and I think the world conscience about Israel is the small David versus this vicious Arabic Goliath, this Muslim Goliath. And that's been the theme that has perpetuated for the last 60 years. And what we're seeing right now, particularly since October 7th, is that meme is being flipped completely. That all of a sudden, it's not Israel that's David, it's Israel that's the Goliath. It's the Palestinian people who are the David. It's the Palestinian people who are being murdered, being abused, being facing genocide, being starved. Everything that used to be, you know, Israel being the persecuted ones, they're the ones persecuting. They're the ones doing the killing in disproportionate amounts. And the numbers bear that out. They always want to talk about Hamas being the terrorist state or the terrorist organization. Yet when you go back and look at all of the terrorist attacks attributed to Hamas since 2000, it numbers something around 1,500. And the majority of those attacks are against military or police targets, not against civilian targets. And 1,500 casualties. Compare that with, you know, when you go back prior to October 7th and then in October 7th, you're approaching 50,000 Palestinians murdered. 50,000. You tell me how 50,000 is somehow justifies 1,500. I mean, it's just the numbers are not
It's not even an eye for an eye, is it? It's 10, 15, 25 eyes for an eye.
Yeah.
Even if you look at it on those metrics. Now, here's a question for you as an expert in the corridors of power. It was Scott Ritter's view that the ICC are not really considering a warrant for the arrest of Netanyahu, that this has actually been got up by Netanyahu himself to inveigle himself in Washington, where, of course, there's a very large amount of skepticism and inbuilt hostility to the ICC.
Right.
Do you think there is going to be a warrant for the arrest of Netanyahu?
No, I'm doubtful of that. But we are seeing, you know, I think today Turkey finally announced it was joining South Africa's case in the ICC against Israel. So I think that's significant. That shows at least in the past, Israel is sort of a, you know, an ally of Turkey or vice versa. And now Erdogan, you know, facing, you know, political defeat at home, he's come to his senses and recognizes he can't continue to collaborate with Israel. But I think Scott's right. Some of this is contrived. It gets to put Netanyahu in a position to be maybe a more sympathetic figure. But let everybody understand one thing. If Netanyahu fell over dead tonight, gone tomorrow, it's not going to change Israel's policy one iota, because the 78% of the Israelis support killing the Palestinians, exterminating the Palestinians, ridding Gaza of Palestinians. So, you know, people shouldn't kid themselves that this is somehow just a policy of a crazed Netanyahu. Bibi Netanyahu he's just a symptom of a far deeper sickness.
Now, we were talking earlier, Larry, about the dichotomy that will crystallize in November. You choose Trump or you choose Biden, or the deep state decides what you chose, however it's worked out. But isn't that the same in America as it is in Britain, as it is in Israel, that both parties actually stand for exactly the same things? It's like two cheeks of the same ass, tightly clenched together, inseparable.
Yeah. We need some Americanized versions of George Galloway over here. You know, I congratulate you on your triumph in your election, you know, trouncing both the Tories and Labor. And unfortunately, we don't have that kind of movement yet in the United States. Both parties, you correctly note, they're corrupt. And even if Trump wins, I don't think it's going to bring about a shift in the policy towards Israel. It will bring about a shift in the policy towards Ukraine. That's a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
And it will bring about a change with respect to China. So from that standpoint alone, I think Trump will at least be able to walk America back from the precipice of nuclear disaster. But, you know, the number of Americans.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. And for that reason, and that reason alone, Larry, I'm hoping that Trump prevails, because it will at least mean that the danger of a nuclear confrontation over Ukraine will swiftly end. In fact, I expect that Trump will go through the whole Ukraine portfolio like a dose of salts, because the corruption of the Biden crime family in Ukraine, if exposed, could finish the Democrats as a political force. So how's that going? Is it looking more likely than not that Trump will win? And will the deep state let him win?
Yeah, the deep state's going to do everything in its power to thwart him. That is true. But at least Trump now recognizes, and his campaign team now recognizes, that the Democrats are likely to cheat. They were extremely naive in 2020. They never imagined that the Democrats would cheat on the scale. And they also didn't realize that some Republicans had also been involved in that kind of cheating, such as the governor of Georgia, Ryan Kemp, was one example. So what they're now got a team of warriors. If you go back to 2020, when within the immediate days after that, stolen election, Trump did not have one organized team to attack it. It was spread out among three or four different groups. Cindy Powell was doing her thing. Rudy Giuliani doing his thing. It was ridiculous. It was not organized. So they've addressed that. They've now got lawyers lined up, ready to go already 6 to 8 months out. That's the first step. The second step is groups like the Heritage Foundation have taken on the task of getting a government organized, ready to go. So that because when Trump ran in 2016, the guy who became famous on television for, hey, you're fired. He was terrible, terrible at hiring people, hired some of the very wrong people you could. And so the Heritage Foundation is moving in to try to correct that, to have some qualified people that would support, let's call it the American First agenda, where America tries to take care of its own social needs and problems here at home before we go out and try to lecture the world on how to fix itself.
Amen. Let's hope that comes to pass. Any word on a running mate yet, Larry?
No. He's kept that a secret. I don't think it's going to be anybody who's currently a member of Congress or Senate, simply because they need every one of those bodies in for the numbers come November. I think it'll be probably a governor, somebody from outside. Tulsi Gabbard, the former Democrat member of the House of Representatives, but something of an independent. She's been mentioned. I think she would be an attractive choice. Apart from that, no word.
Larry Johnson, as always, no wonder you dazzled the UN Security Council. They were lucky to have you, as are we here on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Thanks for joining us again.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Jack is in New Jersey on Netanyahu. Go ahead, Jack.
Hey, how are you, George?
Oh, good. Thank you very much. Enjoying the show. Hope you are.
Yes, very much so. So, yeah, I just wanted to comment on this question, this polling question that you had up, that would Netanyahu be served an arrest warrant by the ICC? Let's look back at a couple of other leaders in history, namely George Bush and Tony Blair. Okay, we got a drunkard fool mm-hmm. and a vampire who essentially, just propagated lies that Iraq was in possession of weapons of mass destruction, got our countries into giant wars, murdered thousands, many, many thousands of innocent Iraqis, and of course, troops on our side as well died. And all the meantime, there were no weapons, okay? So did they ever get served an arrest warrant? Did they ever, get in front of any trial? No, of course not, because they were both a part of the colonial machine, essentially. And now you have this other guy here, Netanyahu, who at the end of the day, it's arguable that, he, controls the world, essentially, when you think about it. By controlling America, he essentially controls the world. And this display that he's been showing, wiping out around 50,000 so far Palestinians, just completely killing innocent women and children, just blanketly. They've proven that they can kill civilians. They haven't proven that they could win a war by killing the enemy, right? But they've proven that they could carpet bomb civilians in mass numbers and wipe them out with high-tech weaponry provided by America, of course. And, it's just, he's not going to be served an arrest warrant, I don't think. He's just going to go on and walk off into the sunset. He might serve another term if the war ends. Maybe he might get voted out, but he's not going to piece of nurse war. It's sad, unfortunately, but I think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, I share quite a few of the points that you made there, Jack, but I have an important difference on one. I don't believe that Netanyahu controls the world. First of all, I don't think anyone right at this minute controls the world. The world is multipolar already. Xi Jinping is a more powerful leader than Joe Biden. And Vladimir Putin is a more powerful leader than any European leader, and by far, and by a considerable distance. And if you put Putin and Xi Jinping together, then the two of them together are easily the most powerful force in the world. China is the biggest economy in the world. Of that, I'm certain, even though they still pretend that they are second for fear of upsetting apple carts that don't yet need to be upset. So, first of all, I don't think anyone controls the world. And crucially, I don't believe that Netanyahu controls the United States of America. The Israel lobby has bought the political process, for sure. But the people who really control America are not these jokers, Johnny this, Javier that, all the multicolored tapestry of the U.S. Congress of unknowns. They don't really run America. What really runs America is the big corporate power, the deep state that serves it, and the armed forces of the United States at its upper military brass. If they wanted Netanyahu to stop, he would have been stopped long ago. Whatever the so-called president of the United States thinks, whatever congressman nobody thinks, whatever senator nobody thinks, the real power in the United States rules Israel just as it rules the United States, and increasingly rules the industrially diminished and degraded and economically diminished and degraded Western European countries. David Lammy, the shadow foreign secretary, apparently said earlier this evening that the global South has got to choose between the United States and China. Well, I've got news for you, Big Eddie Amin of Britain's politics, David Lammy. I've got news for you. The Global South has already chosen, and it ain't your pals in Washington that they have picked. Thanks, Jack. Maureen is in Texas on the protests. Let's hear from her. Go ahead, Maureen.
Yes, hello, George. So I'm calling wanting to give my feelings about what's being done to the students who are protesting here in Texas. Particularly what I've seen on the news is that the University of Texas in Austin, which has long been known as a politically active student body in campus, but
yeah. I've spoken there, actually, Maureen. I've given a speech.
Oh, wonderful.
I've given a speech at the university in Austin, Texas.
Wonderful. And yes, it is a wonderful institution, but it's very
great
unfortunate.
University and a great city. Absolutely. Austin is one of the best cities in the United States.
Yes. Absolutely.
Sorry, go on.
Yes. Oh, no. It's fine, but it's just very unfortunate that my fellow Texans, especially native Texans who pride themselves on being conservative, especially fiscally conservative, anti-government, these are state tax-funded universities, and here the governor, mm-hmm. Greg Abbott, is getting public employees, meaning police and National Guard, to brutalize the students for exercising their First Amendment rights. And when you speak of the banality of evil,
it's like the Constitution has been shredded, Maureen. It's like the American Constitution doesn't exist anymore.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And again, the banality of evil that you
have. Why have the American people gone quietly into that good night?
Oh, yeah, that's unfortunately, I think they're fooled, or the, you know, George W. Bush, Greg Abbott, those supposedly Christian men are leading the citizens who blindly follow them under the veil of anti-Semitism.
It is extraordinary. You know, in the anti-Vietnam War protests, they were all called communists, even though virtually none of them were. Now, the protesters are called anti-Semitic, though virtually none of them are. It is now universally acknowledged that the protesters against the Vietnam War were right. And in time, the same will be true of the anti-Netanyahu, anti-Israel, pro-Palestine protests. But in the main difference between the 60s and 70s, in which I was a participant, my very first ever demonstration was in London in 1968 when I was 14 years old against the Vietnam War. The difference was people hadn't actually allowed their rights to be taken away then. They insisted that those rights, in your case, those constitutional rights, still belonged to them and were still valuable to them. But now you've got the entire American political class effectively demolishing, abolishing the First Amendment of freedom of speech, without appearing to know that without that amendment, there's a reason it's the First Amendment. Without that amendment, without free speech, none of the other constitutional machinery of democracy means anything at all. Because if you can't speak freely, then any thief in the night can steal everything else that you've got. You will have been silenced. Last word to you, Maureen.
Yes, absolutely right. And let's not forget, this is occurring under Joe Biden, a Democratic president.
Yeah, he says democracy is on the ballot. Ah, thanks, Maureen. You've been marvelous. A Texas rose, Maureen in Texas. Anthony Wedgwood says, George, will you have a Workers' Party candidate for Chorley in the general election? It's looking like I may spoil my ballot if only the main parties are on there. It's even better, Anthony. The main parties will not be on the ballot in Chorley because they don't stand against the Speaker of the House. It'll be the Speaker of the House and us, the Workers' Party. You'll have a clear choice. Him or us. You decide. Last call, I think, possibly. Hassan in Manchester on the UK election. Go ahead, Hassan.
Hi, George. How are you doing? Hello?
All good. Thank you very much. What would you like to say?
So basically, what I wanted to point out was something I've been really pondering is that the UK electorate is facing a critical juncture, in my view now, where it has a very big responsibility that the majority of all the, all the parties minus yourself and a few independents are pro-genocide. They have a responsibility here where if they don't take this seriously, it could be, from my view, curtains on the society, or, you know, just the same way as happened in Germany in the past. If a country doesn't seek to stop the support of genocide, a clear open genocide, which the government is participating in, then what does that mean for the future of that society? For me, it means the self-destruction, you know, if you are going to take that route. So for me, it has to be a case that we have to warn people that, look, you have to go out and actively support the ones who are against genocide, because if you don't, you are participating in it. And if you are participating in it, you're no different to those who voted in Nazi Germany, because a lot of those Germans were innocent people, but they just thought, you know what, we don't really care as long as we're okay and, you know, we have ourselves taken care of. We don't want to get involved in a genocide. We're not directly, whatever. But if you don't take that stance, then it's a very, very serious consequence for that country. And I would generally, like, almost, you know, say I would lose hope almost, I would say, in that society. So I think there's a really, really important time for the country. Everyone has a responsibility to go out and tell every person they know, look, you have to vote. I don't care whether they like you or your party or not, but you're the only ones who are standing against genocide. So this is a red line. If you don't see this as a red line, then really there's no hope for the society. And I just wanted to point out to all listeners that they really have to push that.
Well, I couldn't have put that better myself, Hassan. And I'm not going to try and repeat it. As you were coming to an end there, particularly alert viewers may have discerned the sound of Big Ben, its bell tolling. And as Dunn said, John Donne, the old English poet, ask not for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee and for all people. If the annihilation of hundreds of thousands of women and children in the tent city of Rafah begins in the next few hours, and if the blood is running like rivers in the arid soil of Rafah and into the Mediterranean Sea on the front at Gaza, if that happens, that bell is tolling not just for them, but for thee. And as our excellent last call, Hassan in Manchester, just said, it will be tolling for any remaining idea that we were a free country that stood for values that could be counted on to stand up for justice and fairness. And if that happens, Hassan said he will have lost hope. And he'd be right. It would be curtains. It would be good night to the Britain we thought we knew and that we loved. I've gone over my time again. Please forgive me. I hope that you'll join me on Sunday for the Sunday edition of the Mother of All Talk Shows. Sunday is the day we started on. It's also the Lord's Day. There is a real possibility that in the Holy Land, in the Holy Land, by the time we get to Sunday, the crucifixion of the Palestinian people will have moved exponentially into another dimension. In any case, we'll be here to explain what's happened with the best guests and the best callers, and yours truly's hopefully worthy monologue. Thanks for watching.